This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most popular cities in the American West are swollen with people who came in search of a better quality of life, to live closer to nature, and to have better air. These new cities had hoped to avoid the unchecked suburban sprawl that characterized cities in California like Los Angeles. But now some of the new urban West is becoming its own worst nightmare, with bad air alerts, traffic congestion, and the loss of open space. This is what Timothy Egan reported on in his recent New York Times series on urban sprawl in the West. Egan is the Times' Pacific Northwest bureau chief, and he's a third-generation resident of the West. His series focused on six of the 15 fastest-growing metropolitan areas in the nation: Seattle, Portland, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Denver, and Salt Lake City. His series was filled with amazing facts. For instance, the West is the area with the highest percentage of people living in urban areas.
It's amazing when you consider the mythology and just and the contemporary idea as well of the West, which is open spaces. We go there because of public lands. But in fact, 86% of the people in the West live in cities. And one of the many kind of fun facts that my editors on the overcrowded island of Manhattan got a kick out of was the fact that Utah, with 2 million people, is a more urban area than New York State, with 20-plus million people.
Amazing. Another interesting fact, Castle Rock in Douglas County, Colorado, is the fastest growing county in America, but it may go broke. Why might it go broke?
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. Castle Rock itself is okay. They're sort of teetering, but the county there is called Douglas County, and that's where you have the famous Highlands Ranch, which is 10,000 homes on its way to 50,000 homes. They're sort of interchangeable looking. To me, they sort of looked like, you know, Dorothy's home when it lands after going through the hurricane. Imagine 10,000 of those homes all landing, all having three bedrooms, being sort of a beige, non-offensive color, all having cedar decks, and all in this place where people go because they want to have good schools and open space, and they want to flee the urban ills. But ironically, they're in a county now that has the lowest per capita support for their schools because they've got this tax structure that was supposed to be designed to attract folks to begin with, is bankrupting them.
What is it about the tax structure in this county that threatens to bankrupt it?
Well, let's say that 10,000 people come to this county in 3 months, which is almost their pace of growth right now. And those 10,000 people all have to pay property taxes. Those property taxes go to build schools and to help with the basic infrastructure. Well, they have a law which the Republicans passed in their state about 4 or 5 years ago that says, as your tax revenue comes in, you have to reduce the taxes on everyone else so that the overall pot of tax money remains the same. So you never really get any more money from all these people coming in. All it does is bring pressure on those people trying to build schools, those people trying to build roads. Every new person essentially puts you deeper into debt.
Another interesting fact from your series on the new American West, and that is the fastest growing city in America is Las Vegas. But of course, Las Vegas is built on the inhospitable desert. So what are the problems in Las Vegas now?
Well, Vegas is in the middle of the Mojave Desert. The Mojave Desert gets 4 inches of rain a year. Now, Las Vegas had these little artesian wells that sort of burbled up out of the ground, and there were a couple of Paiute Indians that used to come down in the summer and gather around and get water and make mash out of mesquite trees and then retreat back up into the mountains. The Mormons tried to build a settlement there where they thought they could gouge travelers on the way from traveling from Salt Lake to California. That failed. And finally, what came about was this pipeline from the Colorado River to the valley, and they figured as long as we could suck water out of the Colorado River, we could build a city here. Now, it didn't really mean much until the late 1980s when Southern California started to empty out en masse. And Vegas became sort of the ultimate California suburb. It's only 280 miles from California. But you look at it, and it is absolutely reaching its limit. Now, Saudi Arabia hasn't done any better than people in America have at building a massive city in a place that gets 0 to 4 inches of rain. They are running out of water in Las Vegas. They'll be maxed out in less than 10 years. And they're building homes at the rate of better than one home every 45 minutes. I mean, Vegas sort of is the epitome of the Edward Abbey line, where he said that the philosophy of unfettered growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell. And you can look at Vegas and watch it just spreading hour by hour, acre by acre. There's nobody saying no, because that goes against sort of the grain of what's keeping everything on a high right there now.
And there's nobody saying, no, sorry, there's not enough water to support these.
Well, they tried that, Terry. In 1991, they had a brief moratorium. They realized they were running out of water, and they had a moratorium. And the town just went nuts. They said, no, we can't do that. We have to continue to create Venice, which is the next city they're going to create on the Vegas Strip, or create New York, New York. I mean, you have this wonderful irony right now where they're building the old cities of the world on the Strip. New York, New York opened this month, complete with the Hudson River out front and the tugboats. And the next big project is to create Venice, complete with canals and all of that. Now, while on the Strip, they're creating New York, New York, Venice, and Paris is on the books as well. Around the Strip, they are creating sort of L.A. circa the Blade Runner era. So you have this fascinating thing going up around it. Most people don't know, but almost all of Vegas now is outside of the city limits, so they can't tax any of these subdivisions. They have all these gated communities built, by the way, on the Howard Hughes model. Hughes was the first visionary of the gated community. Remember, Hughes came to Vegas, and he holed up in the Desert Inn, and he never opened his blinds for the 9 years that he lived in this suite, and he had this perfectly climate-controlled room in the middle of the Mojave Desert. Well, Hughes also had this idea to build a residential community that somewhat matched his neuroses. And so now you have the fastest-growing areas in Vegas are these guarded, climate-controlled communities named things like Harbor Vista. Harbor is spelled H-A-R-B-O-U-R. Mariner's Cove, which is a place we should have here in Seattle. Green Valley, Somerset Heights, you know, all these sort of old English green 40 inches of rain kind of places. They're all gated. They're all climate controlled. They have artificial lakes, and it's all from just utterly draining and sucking out their groundwater in the Colorado River. Well, now they're at a peak, and they've got nothing to do except for go to the rest of the seven states in the West and say, look, we've maxed out our water supply. We're the fastest growing city in America. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to let us die of thirst? So their idea is that they can just sort of present themselves and that the law of the river, the Colorado River Pact, will have to be entirely rewritten to match them.
Timothy Egan is my guest, and he's a New York Times bureau chief in the Pacific Northwest. You know, it's ironic. You know, a lot of people moved out to the Arizona desert for respiratory conditions. Their doctor told them they'd breathe better there. And now in the suburbs of Phoenix, for instance, people are warned to stay indoors on bad air days if they have respiratory problems.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, one of the oldest things of the arid West, starting before the turn of the century, is go west to improve your health. And people would come out here and they'd say, my God, I feel better already. And they live 30, 40 years past the time they were supposed to die because whether it was an effect of thinking they were feeling better or the air itself. But now they have these air alerts, not just in Phoenix, which is, you know, where all these snowbirds are, but they have them in Salt Lake City, which will be which will host the 2002 Olympics. They have them in Denver, and they have them in Las Vegas. So in addition to the next day's weather forecast, you hear this thing about tomorrow's going to be unhealthful in the afternoon. We advise most children under the age of 10 and most people over the age of 60 not to go outside. And you'll hear that right after the five-day forecast, which is for 5 days of 65-degree weather. But you can't do anything about it.
To sum up, how would you describe the typical city in the new urban West?
The typical city in the new urban West is like a teenager who's 17 years old, is great-looking, can run the 100-yard dash in 9.2 seconds, thinks they will never die, thinks they will never age, thinks that, you know, they're just invulnerable. These cities are all set in spectacular areas, and whether it's the Sonoran Desert, which I love, or the Rocky Mountains, which I also love, or Puget Sound, or the Willamette Valley, which is where I'm from. I'm a third-generation Westerner, so I consider myself someone who would never leave this area ever. But these cities, because they're set in such beautiful areas, they've got this sort of disease that a really good-looking teenager has. They think they will never get wrinkles, as I said. And so they think they cannot repeat these mistakes.
What are some of the situations that led to the problems that these new American cities in the West have? Let's start with the role of developers. Do you see them as being among the more guilty parties?
Well, I don't really want to put a moral value on developers. They just do what they do, which is to build homes and try to do whatever they have to do legally to get around the local county commissioner so they can keep building homes, sell them for a 20 or 30% profit, then move on to the next scratch of open land and build more homes. if you want to look around at guilty parties, you can look at the people who were elected to try to do something about these cities. Now, we can talk a little bit about Portland later. There is a pattern that all of these cities follow, and it goes like this. It starts with the grand vision. We will be something different. We're set in a great place. We're destined to be different because we're made up of people who came from bad places. Therefore, we're gonna not repeat the mistakes. So you hear a lot of talk, for example, here in Seattle, of creating Paris on Puget Sound. You hear a lot of talk in Salt Lake City of the great, you know, first great American city of the new century, so they'll have their 2002 Olympics. So they start with a great plan of being terrific. But then the common pattern is they have these balkanized governments where 27 little cities and suburbs are all making decisions. So there's no grand vision ever put on the place. There's grand visionary rhetoric that always comes out that says we won't repeat the mistakes, but there's no grand political plan. So you have the classic pattern of developers going into whatever jurisdiction has to be massaged, to use the euphemism. And that can be a county, that can be a town government, that can be a planning agency. And they just do what they have to do to get the permits to move on to the next scratch of open land. And only one city of these six that I looked at, Portland, has tried to say from the start, no, we're going to speak with one political plan. We're going to enforce a urban growth boundary around every city in this state. We're going to say this far and no more. So I think the pattern is you start feeling terrific, but it breaks down in the political structure because you have these balkanized 27, 35 little individual governments. Another thing I should mention, though, is that for a long time, cities like Salt Lake, Denver, and Phoenix were sort of modest towns with, I guess you could say, much to be modest about. And they went through terrible recessions. Phoenix had the great SNL bust. Salt Lake City had the mining bust. And Denver, of course, had the energy boom that went bust as well. They also had SNL problems. And so what they did in the early 80s was to try to attract as many people as they could by having these really great tax structures and by letting down their guard on sprawl and by loosening these impact fees that they were charging developers and by basically saying, okay, we've got to create a new economy here. How do we do it? Well, we'll try to bring in these new clean companies. And the irony is, Terry, that like in Denver, for example, this new boom is not built on tearing down the Rockies. I mean, in the 80s, you had all these shale companies and all these oil companies going in and just literally ripping open the seams in the mountains. Now Denver is this sort of clean industry center. It's TCI cable, it's telecommunications. But while they're not tearing open the Rockies, they're committing the worst mistakes that cities can make according to, you know, folks who look at these things and say, what should we not do?
My guest is Timothy Egan, the New York Times Pacific Northwest Bureau Chief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Egan, and he's the Pacific Northwest Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He's actually just starting a six-month leave to complete a book. You say the city that did it right is Portland. And you date that back to the 1970s when Portland drew a line around the metropolitan area. What was the line for?
Well, they had a Republican governor named Tom McCall, great, tall, lanky, sort of Lincoln-esque figure. There are statues in his honor already around the state of Oregon. And McCall liked to go around and say he loved Oregon more than life itself. And, you know, he was the person who made the famous statement, come visit Oregon, but for God's sake, don't come and live here. He really tapped into sort of the Northwest xenophobia in the sense that the main thing they fear is Californians. And so he got a thing that passed through his legislature in the mid-1970s, and it was an absolutely revolutionary law for the United States because we're one of the countries where it values private property rights almost more than anything. And this law simply said that every city of any size in the state of Oregon had to come up with an urban growth boundary, essentially just a line. They just had to go out there and draw a line and say this far and no more. On one side of the line would be the city and all that the city represents. On the other side would be orchards, forests, vineyards, just open space, mountains, anything. So when you go down to Portland, you're really struck by the fact, now here's a vibrant, fast-growing, hugely prosperous, wonderful, gleaming, polished new American city with about 1.5 million people in its metro area. And you can go 9 miles from the center of town and you're strolling in these sort of Tuscan vineyards. You know, Oregon makes a terrific Pinot Noir, if you've never had it. A little plug for their wines. Or you're strolling in these pear orchards, or you're walking along a forested path, and you're on this in this part of Oregon that looks like Oregon maybe looked like 200, 300 years ago. Developers just went ape over the thing. They three times brought a measure before the voters to try to roll it back, and three times the voters in the state of Oregon all voted to keep the urban growth boundary. There were lawsuits. It's gone to several courts. But the thing is held, it's worked, and polls show that 80% of the people in Oregon love it. And the fact that they don't have what people here call Californication can be attributed to that law.
How are other cities now borrowing from the Portland model, and is it too late for them?
I don't know. I mean, I did a series a few years back called Who Owns the West, which looked at all the public land battles, which you know a lot about, and I've always been sort of interested in the soul of the West, and I thought the fight was always over, you know, the great 500 million acres that we all own, the public land. I've now sort of shifted my view a little bit. I think the fight is really over, can people live somewhat in harmony in these cities next to wild nature? You know, when an acre goes into development, it never comes back. At least when an acre is logged, there's a chance that it'll grow back. So you look at California now again, to go back to the source of all this. And you have to live in the West, by the way, to appreciate how much people in the other cities really do despise California. Someone actually did a study recently that showed it's almost like Western racism is to look at California as the source of all evil. And all these new cities are just full of Californians who fled the Golden State because they think it no longer works. Well, right now in California, you have four cities that have voted just in the last year, including San Jose, to do exactly what Portland did. So not only is California coming out with these reports like Bank of America, where they realize what their awful mistake was, they're now taking very strong measures to stop it in its tracks, to basically say, look, we're going to grow, but we're going to grow right in this given urban area. We're going to say, this is how we want the city to look. We want there to be a little open field where somebody can go for a walk 80 years from now.
Now, you mentioned highways as being part of the problem. That, what was it, a mile of highway creates four times the number?
Brings a fourfold increase in traffic. That's correct.
Yeah. Now, how has Portland handled highways? Are they a model for highway development, Portland, too?
Yeah. You know, the idea in the West has always been that people wouldn't really take to public transit because we all have our cars and we all have, you know, I have a Jeep Cherokee. I'm as bad as anyone else. I like to have a four-wheel drive in the snow. But Portland took their traffic money. Instead of building new roads, they did this, again, this pretty radical thing. They went down and tore a freeway down. They just ripped the thing out. It went along the Willamette River, and that place where their freeway used to be is now called Tom McCall Park, and it's the most used park in all of Portland. Now, the other thing they did, and this is actually more important than Tom McCall Park, is they built this mass transit system, and it's called MAX. You know, it has this cute little name like Tickle Me Elmo, and people come to Oregon and they say on a Saturday morning they want to go get on MAX as sort of a tourist thing. It's almost like this anomaly. Let's ride the cute little train into town. And ridership has gone far beyond what even the most optimistic people ever projected for this MAX mass transit system. The other thing they did, which was radical, and they got sued on, but it's held up, they said, we're going to limit parking spaces. We're going to say you can't have any more than, say, just for a number, 20,000 parking spaces in all of downtown, period. And then they limited the size of stores, which is really unheard of. So instead of having these boxy mega stores, which is what they're trying to avoid, they have limited new retail stores in the suburban areas to 60,000 square feet, which is just a little bigger than Bill Gates' home. So, you know, and they've limited parking spaces, limited stores, limited... they basically forced you to take their public transit system. If you can't find a place to park, you're going to take little MAX, the little train, or you're going to take the bus system.
You know, I guess I'm wondering what you see for the future, because the new Western cities that you're talking about are in many ways the cities of the future. They're the cities a lot of people look to see what the new cities are like or what the new cities will be like. So what kind of pattern are you seeing? What do you see when you look ahead?
This is a really hard thing for me to say because... I'm a third generation Westerner, and I love this region. I always think that that this is the, as Wallace Stegner said, the geography of hope is in the West, and I do believe that. But it's just stunning to see these cities go down the same path. So I wonder if you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, all of us journalists will be going back to Denver and going to Seattle to write the story about how they failed. I mean, the old idea was that America moved west, we reached the Pacific, we could go no more, so we sort of splashed back and we would force ourselves to build terrific cities because there was no other place to go. And I always thought, well, that would be the limiting factor. But in fact, it is not the limiting factor. So I guess what I see for the future are a series of city-states. I mean, it's already there. You're not gonna strip these things away. I see these six regional powerhouses. They're all about 60 to 80 miles long. They all have these great new economies. But slowly, day by day, they're becoming bad places to live. And that may not mean something to a lot of people, but the fact of the matter is these cities were all built on the philosophy that it doesn't matter so much what you do at work as it does what you do after work. You know, these are quality of life places. These are places where people go and have kayaks on their car rack and go mountain biking at 4 o'clock. And there's a serious subculture of lawyers turned carpenters.
Timothy Egan, he reports on the Pacific Northwest for the New York Times. He just started a 6-month leave of absence to complete a book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.